ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Have you ever wondered why everyone's worried about microplastics?
Or what the best time of day is to exercise?
And why are some people left-handed, Tegan?
Well, the best people are. Anyway, we've got the show for you. It's called What's That Rash?
Where we answer the health questions everyone's asking. I'm physician and journalist Dr. Norman Swan.
And I'm health reporter Tegan Taylor.
And we promise we're not here to sell you supplements.
It is surprisingly hard to find podcast hosts who aren't.
But we do want you to search for What's That Rash in the ABC Listen app.
And we might answer your question next.
If there's one thing the Iran war has taught us recently, it's that mis- and disinformation, supercharged by AI, is making it harder to trust our very own eyes.
It's quite aside from AI, with the sheer amount of information headed our way on a daily basis. Just sorting through that information with a critical eye is becoming difficult.
This is the first in our mini-series on mis- and disinformation.
Today we'll explore deep reading and what it means to engage critically with information. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
I'm Hamish McDonald. This is The Matter of Facts on Global Roaming.
So, Hamish, this is a very big week in your life. The Matter of Facts is starting. All that work.
Yes, it has been a bit of work, Jerry. There's a new TV show that you can find on ABC TV this week. It's called The Matter of Facts. And here on Global Roaming, we're going to be doing a companion mini-series. I've been filming this over the last 12, 18 months, darting off all over the world on the weekends, filming this series really about the post-truth world that we're all living in right now.
And how that relates to each and every one of us. And, you know, whether we're mired in it or whether there are things we can do about it.
Yeah, I think it can be quite easy to get overwhelmed, Jerry, with the amount of information that's flowing at us, both through the traditional media forms, but also on social media, all the other various methods, but also because of the arrival of AI and what that means for our information systems. Fundamentally, I think the world's information systems have become heavily polluted, and as individuals, it can be pretty hard to know how to work within that and to know what is true and what is false. We can probably all think of examples where we're watching something or reading something or listening to something, and we don't know whether it's real or not. Have you had that experience, Jerry?
Oh, definitely. In fact, because I look at animal videos, I have to confess, I love them. And I am learning to identify the ones that are AI generated. There are little clues which I'm trying to pick up on.
And so do you think, Jerry, that you're good at spotting what's real and fake?
Not bad.
Well, I say that because statistically, and this we discovered in the TV series, statistically we all have about a 50-50 chance of spotting what's real and what's fake. But the more confident you are, the less likely you are to actually spot the fake.
Oh, I feel a trap coming. Trap coming on.
Yeah, well, that is what the statistics show, Jerry. The research bears that out.
I wonder why that is.
Well, in a sense, it's our mind tricking us, essentially.
And then we're doubling down, sort of thing, with confidence.
Yeah, this is what I think is happening for all of us. They talk about something called the liar's dividend. You don't need everything on the internet to be fake. You just need enough of it to be fake to raise doubt for people. And then it starts to kind of eat away, you know, erode people's trust in the information that they're receiving.
I'm not convinced it erodes full trust. I'm just not.
There was an incident though, wasn't there, Jerry, when you and I were in Bondi at the end of last year. We were putting together that emergency episode in the wake of the Bondi attack. Do you remember coming up to me and telling me about an image?
Oh, yes. I certainly do remember that image that went viral on the net. Two young policewomen at Bondi near the bridge, the famous bridge, and it was actually a young man who said to me, you know, those women froze, because it had been suggested to him on the net that they froze and they couldn't handle the pressure, when the absolute reverse was the truth.
Yeah, so this was an image that had been both cropped and manipulated, it turned out, to make it look like the police officers were scared and didn't do anything when, as you say, the reverse was true. They were running into the line of fire towards it and they were holding people back. So you can kind of see how these manipulated images twist or even flip the narrative in the moment They do sow doubt. It picked up traction on social media at the time. It's precisely what happened in the wake of the Bondi attack. People were, in part because of that image, questioning whether police had done enough.
So who are we going to welcome now? Which luminary are we going to invite on?
Yeah, we're going to be asking on this episode whether the way we're consuming information today is doing something different to our brains. We're talking to Marianne Wolfe. She's the director of the Centre for Dyslexia, Diverse Learners and Social Justice at UCLA. But she's actually an expert on the effects of the digital world on our brains. So if you've been thinking to yourself that there's something different going on right now, if that's how it kind of feels to you, this is precisely what Marianne's area of expertise is. If you've watched the TV series or watching it, the matter of fact, she features in it, and here she is now.
Marianne, welcome to Global Roaming.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I only wish I were in Australia this very moment.
Marianne, your research focuses on what reading does to our brains, but what is this tidal wave of information that's coming at all of us digitally doing to our brains?
Well, the first thing you have to know is that the brain wasn't meant to read at all. It is like any new cognitive invention. The brain has the capacity, it's a design principle that's beautiful, to make a new circuit. And so reading actually makes a whole new circuit of connections in the brain that strengthen parts of it, and through its connectivity gives a platform for new ways of thinking, for new ways of communicating. So it's quite a difference of a brain that is literate or non-literate because of these changes to the very connectivity of the component parts of the brain.
And I suppose social media, which involves moving from a page to a screen, is introducing a whole new set of sort of circuits into our brain. Or at least I think that's what you're trying to find out, isn't it?
Geraldine, that's really, for me, one of the, if you will, most urgent questions that we can address in our research. The reality is that the brain of a reader has a plastic circuit. And that plasticity means that that circuit will change according to the language. There'll be a slightly different circuit for Chinese and Japanese kanji than English. But it also means that how we read, the medium upon which we read, will also change how the circuit works. So what happens is that the medium upon which you read has what are called affordances, characteristics. And print is a medium whose affordances or characteristics actually propels the allocation of our attention to really time-consuming, effortful, sophisticated processes. Now, I'm going to say them really fast for your audience, but they need to think about this carefully themselves. The reading brain on print is advantaging giving time and attention to background knowledge, checking, inference, who's saying what, why, empathy, what is the perspective of others, and most importantly to me and undoubtedly to you, critical thinking, critical analysis of how all of those different processes help us figure out what is the information and how well that information matches what we know or doesn't. And the disequilibrium, if it's not matched, needs critical thinking. So print as a medium advantages the more time-consuming processes. Now, the question that you have immediately in your mind, Geraldine, is what about the digital characteristics? What about the digital affordances? The reality is that if we use things like eye movement research or imaging, what we see is that what we do in digital more than likely makes skimming the norm. We are going from word to word, sentence to sentence, thought to thought, but we don't give enough time when that's the medium to that reading circuit that I just described that gives time to these deep reading processes. So there's a fundamental set of advantages and disadvantages to each medium. But my concern, especially as a developmentalist, is that we don't develop a brain through print that gives an advantage to these time, very time-consuming, sophisticated processes.
So what's the difference then for us humans between reading a book and then consuming words on lots of different devices? You know, lots of different tabs open, apps pinging around. Is that actually doing something different to our brain?
That's exactly right. You are completely distracted. You are in a state of what was once called by Linda Stone, continuous partial attention. And there's a beautiful analogy in philosophy by the Korean philosopher Han Byung-chul. He says that, you know, as a society, we are moving so quickly from event to event that we have no time to do exactly what you said. We have no time to process a gap in between in a slightly different context to think about what we're doing when we move from event to event or sentence to sentence or word to word.
So this is really interesting, Marianne, because as part of the TV series, I went to Melbourne University, the School of Psychology, had my head wired up to all of these cables, and I was shown experiments with what happens to my brain when I'm consuming digital information versus just reading a book. And when I was being presented with a bunch of digital distractions, the screens, the kind of read on what was happening in my brain was very messy and colourful and pretty chaotic, it's got to be said. But then when they handed me a book, it was an entirely different picture. Suddenly, that chaos on the monitors just became these beautiful smooth waves. And actually, I was just kind of asleep in a couple of minutes.
Oh, my goodness. But that's not the ideal. I want immersion, not sleep. But, you know, there's a beautiful line in poetry about what poetry gives us. And it's the idea was we have a quiet eye. And I extend that to what's happening to the brain. We have a brain, let's just call it a mind, a quiet mind. And because there's so much affect that happens when we give it time, I liken it to having a quiet eye, a quiet mind, and a quieter heart, actually, that becomes involved.
Yes, that quieter heart is what slightly bothers me, because I don't think I'm fully persuaded yet about that impact, that, you know, whether we might have lost the quiet mind, yes, in a cognitive sense, but is that necessarily different to what came before?
You know, whether we are persuaded by what I say, we should be persuaded by the evidence that's out there developmentally. And so let's just say that one of our major goals is the comprehension of what we read. What you see in these meta-analyses that come from what's called the eRead European Network is that you're reading the same exact material shows very significant differences between the comprehension ability of the people reading print versus screen. And what happens is with screen, because we are skimming, more than likely, we are missing elements of the plot, we're missing sequence, we're missing that sense of really entering. And that's a term that a lot of people call immersion. We aren't entering the space in the same way. Now, there is brain imaging research as well on this that shows differences in how things are connected to cognition. And if when I say quiet eye or quiet mind, what I'm actually talking about is the strength of connections that either happen or do not happen when we're reading on different mediums. So there's research from infancy to adulthood on this.
Yes, it's interesting because, you know, Marianne, in the 19th and 18th and 19th centuries, when books were suddenly being printed en masse for the first time, more or less, there was a great deal of concern that reading was damaging people's minds, particularly young women. that it was a bad thing for society that women were exposed to all this writing and were sort of, there was book mania, they said. So, which is the very thing that you now want to happen. So how can we say that, you know, this is changing the way our brains connect? How can you go from that to saying this is good or this is bad for society? It's that broader element I'm still not persuaded of.
Geraldine, one of the harder aspects of this work was that I actually felt I had to leave the realm of being a, if you will, a basic researcher in cognitive neuroscience and talk about the implications for society. If we have a brain that is so accustomed to being skimming, and often that's connected to going to sites that give confirmatory bias, if you want to use one of those words, confirmatory bias to what that particular line or silo always gives you, you are less likely to use critical thinking when you enter such a silo. And when you're skimming it, it's a double problem. You are no longer really making that critical analysis because you assume it's what you know. So the combination of skimming and confirmatory bias in our citizens leads them to be more susceptible to misinformation and, worst of all, in my country and yours, disinformation, intentional falsification of information for a particular profit or for a particular goal. And so I've never leave cognitive neuroscience or the study of literature behind, but I had to expand my thinking to look at the implications for society, especially a democracy that requires the voices of many and does not, if you will, think about others. And I think it was Marilynne Robinson who said this, that the greatest threat to democracy is to make others the enemy. And that's what misinformation and disinformation often does, polarizes us. These others are the enemy, and everyone who agrees with you is friend. This is the death knell of a democratic society, to think in those very binary ways.
That's Marianne Wolfe talking to Hamish and me for the first episode in our Matter of Fact series on global roaming. Stay tuned for more fascinating discussion about whether social media is creating knowledge inequality. There's that very interesting case against Meta right now, isn't it? The lawsuit by the teenager around the harms of Instagram on young users. And what this case, as I understand it, is trying to decide is whether Meta knew how addictive their algorithms were and tried to hide it, or they did not. So there's a question here really of legal responsibility.
Yes, I'm aware of that case. I'm very interested in what it will do. I'm less interested in the use of the courts for this than I am for trying to have public opinion understand that their attention is being sold, if you will, and used both for profit and for successful, if you will, in politics, for a successful platform or something. So there are those people, especially in California, like Tristan Harris, who have groups and are truly organized around some of the issues here. And they liken what is happening now to the knowledge that our tobacco industry had years ago about the addictive quality of tobacco, but how profit basically trumped, a word I don't like to use, but how profit trumped the science that they possessed, and that we are now in this moment where we know that there's great addictive aspects here. I don't feel, as a scientist, that I can say what with any great conviction that this is the direction we should go. I rather believe that it is the education of the public that's necessary rather than a judicial approach to it. But if it's raising consciousness, that is a good thing. Just as you are raising consciousness.
So we've seen examples of where governments have tried to regulate, Maryam. I'm thinking of the social media ban for under 16s here in Australia. It's difficult. And with the arrival of AI, you can see how governments are struggling to even comprehend how to tackle it. So is it better then to just focus on the individual? What can we all do to respond? How do we arm ourselves as citizens?
Such a good question. My book was actually translated in French and given to Macron, of all things. And it was his wife who, I think, read it. I can't say he didn't read it, but let me just only say I know she did. And she began to be very aware and was involved in an organized way to regulate the use of cell phones in schools. And so there are things that all of us can do that are just, if you will, common sense. And I think some of common sense has flown out the digital window here, you know, and I feel that if we had, if it's not regulations as it, in a large sense, but just common sense saying we don't use cell phones in school, we have, if you will, parameters that parents and families should know about that can help them have some sense of their own ability to contribute to their child's digital wisdom. That it's, you know, and I will say that I'm going to be speaking and have been speaking to some universities of pure digital natives. And what I say to them, and as a sort of answer to you, Hamish, is that we need to see deep reading, this reading that I'm talking about that's critical, empathic, inferential, all that, that's an act of resistance against a society that is accelerated so much that we can't even have the research this moment to say whether what is happening is good or bad, because it's both. And when you have parallel truths like this going on, you need a public that demands research. And of course, that's my own stance. We need to have knowledge, and we don't have it. I would never be able in my university, UCLA, to run a study the way AI has overtaken our world, right? I'd never be allowed, because the question you ask is, what does this innovation disrupt in development or in fact destroy? We don't ask that question now. We should be asking over and over, what does this disrupt in the development of a good human being? We should be asking that. And we should be asking our companies that.
So this is really interesting, Maryam. I've been thinking a lot about this recently, and you've just kind of prompted me to return to this thought. It's that we talk a lot about economic inequality, and I reckon we're going to have to start talking about knowledge inequality. So different cohorts essentially diverging between the knowledgeable, the people that are curious, that are doing deep reading, that maybe generationally have grown up with a different form of consuming information, and then cohorts, demographics that don't, that consume bite-sized information, that don't necessarily have those critical thinking skills or can do the longer, deeper form mm-hmm. of reading. And that you'll actually get a really big gulf between those cohorts.
You know, unfortunately, I agree in large part with what you're saying, or it's a great concern. And I was just at a university in Boston in which it was sponsored by the humanities, and they were completely in accord with what I was saying, but the reality is they may lose their very department of humanities, that we are, you know, that has become like, that's an elite function of a university, and when it should be the very basis of a liberal arts institution. So I am very concerned about just what you're saying, but it goes back to actually what Geraldine is asking, and that is, well, is this any different? Yes, it is different. I think we have to understand those differences. And I'm the last person in the world to say we fully understand it. I've been working on the reading brain for more than 20 years, and I never, ever thought the changes would be so great according to how we read, and how that those changes in how we read is influencing what we read and what is even being written. You know, publishers are affected by this as well. There's many aspects. And the last thing I want is that we only have elite deep readers. That's just that's the antithesis of what I want, but that is a product or an implication of what you're saying. We have to fight against that. And for me, I'll finish it. I get too excited about this, but for me, it begins with childhood and education, and that we educate our children to really understand the beauty of what reading can give them, and the idea of the interiority. You know, I think we've lost that somehow, the beauty of it. I mean, David Brooks once said that somewhere along the line, beauty went missing.
Oh, look, I'm sorry, but I do think once you start talking about beauty going missing, it does sound a little bit to me like moral panic, Marianne.
You know what? Panic is, the wrong word. Moral concern. I think this should be a matter of ultimate concern. It's not a panic. Panic is when we have lost all control. I don't believe we have lost control, but we are losing it. Yes.
Then really it is about literacy. I mean, it's, I suppose, about making sure that there's always a good book available. Is that it?
Well, yes, and teaching and making it, you know, bring the idea that reading has a home in us where our best thoughts are available. You know, Jerry, why are you thinking about it? I want to ask you, so because you've been asking me, so I want to ask you, why in the world are you putting it in the classification of panic rather than raising consciousness?
I think it's because I see my own grandchildren and I see that some are readers and some are not. And they're raised around technology. They just are. And I'm certainly not drawing definite conclusions about how they're going to turn out as a result of this. So I'm just being a little cautious about over-worrying.
Yeah, it's a synaptic leap. It's a synaptic leap to make that conclusion. I've only had to come to it begrudgingly. I felt like Rip Van Winkle when I started thinking these sorts of, what? Where have I been? But now I just accept it. This is a reality. I'm going to not just resist it. I'm going to say resistance is an act of hope for making a better species. That's why I don't like the word panic. Ultimate concern.
Ultimate concern. Okay. A great place to leave it right there. Thank you so much, Marianne.
Bye-bye. Thank you both.
Well, what a fascinating discussion there with Marianne Wolfe, a very emotional discussion. And that's just part one of our companion series to Hamish's new show, The Matter of Facts. We'll bring you another deep dive into mis- and disinformation next Monday. In the meantime, do check out the TV show on ABC Tuesday night and write to us here, global.roaming@abc.net.au.
We'll be back again tomorrow, 11 a.m. and 9 p.m. on Radio National, anytime on ABC Listen. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.